It is a little bit after 10 in the a.m. on a Tuesday morning here at the radio station, and that can only mean one thing. It's time for mid-morning coffee break with Adam. Last week, our frequent co-commentator, official WWGH presidentologist, was a bit under the weather. I guess the summer that they get 11 months out of the year in Florida kind of did him in temporarily, but we're pleased to report that Dr. Ron Fineman has recovered. He is feeling fantastic, fabulous, and ready to join me here at the WWGH microphones. It was Father's Day a couple days ago, Ron. You talked about, welcome back to our airwaves after 2 weeks.
Thank you very much, Adam, for inviting me back. My voice is back now. Thank you.
Well, that's always good to hear. So it was Father's Day a couple days ago. You posted some photos and thoughts about your two sons, David and Paul, if I'm not mistaken. I was never that good with names,
yes.
But I think I got that right. Of course,
David and Paul, yes.
That photo of yourself back, I guess it would have been early 1980s, look a little bit cross between Gabe Kaplan and Marty Allen. You really got a nice fluffy head of hair going on there, Ron. I think your look was quite.
I've often been compared to Gabe Kaplan, never really to Marty Allen. I prefer Gabe Kaplan.
Of course, he's in the educational business also, at least in his character on Welcome Back,
yeah,
Cotter.
Yeah, Welcome Back, Cotter in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah, my mom always enjoyed that.
And he's my age, by the way. He's 3 months younger than me. I looked him up. He's born in March 45. I'm born in December 44, so we're actually the same time frame, yeah.
Well, that might have actually been Gabe Kaplan. Never quite. No, maybe you're one of the same person.
Well, I wouldn't mind having the success he had as a comedian.
We won't say Welcome Back, Cotter this week. We'll say Welcome Back, Ronald. Because, again, last week, Ron, we played an encore of our little debate between you and Mike Essen. I know you listened to it again. Definitely some different viewpoints. You know, differing views are what makes the world go round, especially here in the United States. But you guys certainly, although demographically you're similar in some ways, but in terms of beliefs, quite polar opposites.
Very definitely very different. And listening to it, I really rolled my eyes quite a bit.
But it's okay to think a little different from your peers. And right now, there is a major division of opinion on immigration and other issues in this country. I've said it before, but it's a tenuous time, to put it mildly. Ron, you've been on this earth a lot longer than, well, not much longer, but somewhat longer than I have. Have you ever seen more conflict and disagreement among immigration? Let's look at that. That's the big issue that we're seeing right now. Is this perhaps the most divisive time for the immigration issue in the history of the world? Or where do you put this in terms of other times in history when immigration has been at the forefront?
Well, I would say this: in my lifetime, this is the worst time, I think. But of course, before I was born, there was World War II and the mass loss of life and the Holocaust of Jews and non-Jews and people trying to escape. And it's obvious to me people have forgotten what it was like back then, or they never studied the history of that. But it is very disturbing what's going on, and it's just heartbreaking to see the stories of what's happening with these kids being separated from their parents, because that is a traumatic experience that will affect the rest of their lives. It's not just going to be, oh, well, you get over it. It doesn't happen that way with little kids. So I think it's a crime against humanity, really. It's just unacceptable to separate people from their, from their parents, especially young children.
One thing that's crossed my mind, Ron, and I know it's a sensitive question, but there are different types of immigrants, even the term legal and versus illegal immigrants. There are different types of illegal immigrants. But one kind certainly are those who illegally cross the border, scaling a fence or a body of water, etc. And that obviously is very frowned upon and not something I don't think anybody supports. The problem is when they take their kids with them, and the kids are innocent bystanders. And I've seen memes on Facebook that say, well, if you don't want to get separated from your kids, don't cross the border illegally and may show people scaling a fence. What are your thoughts on that, Ron? The parents, in my opinion, are very, very poor role models. They're criminals entering the country illegally. The kids are innocent bystanders. You know, but what do you do?
Way. Well, it's a real problem. I agree with that. But the point is, under the Obama administration, the families were kept together while they were going through processing, whether they were going to be allowed to remain in the country or be pushed out. That's the issue to me more than anything. It's not that everybody has to be admitted, but you don't separate children from their parents, particularly a nursing baby being separated from his mother, or a 2 or 3 year old who can't even express himself yet, and suddenly he has to have his mommy or his daddy with him. I mean, to me, that's just, it reminds me too much of the kind of a situation that we saw in the 1930s in camps that the Nazis set up, and then they finally decided, well, they're going to go further. They're going to actually execute people. And I'm not so sure. There's already some people thinking that if Trump could get away with it, he would go that far. Of course, he probably can't get away with it. But I think we have a very Nazi-like situation now in the way that people are looked at as if they're inferior beings that have no rights at all and that their children could be separated from them. Now, do I think they should be coming over, you know, without permission? No, of course not. But I also have to point out that people can hand themselves in at the border. They're not really coming in illegally, but now they're being treated as if they're criminals just by coming to the border.
Question for you, Ron, and I know it's not an easy thing to talk about, but this seems somewhat obvious to me. A person who enters the United States by crossing a scaling a fence or crossing a body of water, obviously breaking into the country. We're not talking about everybody in this situation where the kids are separated and put in cages or et cetera. I'm talking about the case where people are adults bringing their kids are entering the United States through a blatantly illegal means. Now, my question is if a person breaks into a business or a home, and may or may not bring the kids with him or her as innocent bystanders, that person goes to jail and has committed a serious criminal offense. You don't take the kids to jail with them. You obviously want to be sure the kids are cared for. And I would imagine they go to a foster home or something, obviously not put in a cage. But what's the difference here? Again, somebody entering the country illegally, that's a serious offense, and I have no tolerance for it. And I know you don't either. It's just, what do you do with the innocent bystanders who are kids? Is that a fair analogy to compare to someone who breaks into a house or a business? And what do you do with their kids versus this situation? What are the differences, and how should the treatment of the families be different?
Well, to be honest, I don't agree with you on that. It's the same thing as breaking into a house.
Well, I'm not saying it's the same. I mean, it's an example of somebody breaking into a country, a business, a home, what have you, and doing it illegally, blatantly illegally.
Well, the thing is, I remember once or twice when I was younger, the car broke down when I was driving and it was dark and I had to go over to someone's house and knock on the door and ask for help. This is before the age of cell phones and all that. And I remember being upset and I was a teenager. And I'm thinking that here we're having people who in most cases are not coming to cause trouble. They're coming here because they're escaping poverty and they're escaping, indeed violence and crime and trying to make a better life for themselves and their children. So I just don't see it in the same way as many other people see it, that they're not really criminals. Even if they come in, you know, by going through the desert of Mexico, which many of them die, you know, on the way up, to me, they're sacrificing to come up to make a better life for their family to escape horrible conditions in Central America. And they are terrible, and we can't solve the problem of Central America, I agree, but I don't think we should look at it as if they are criminals. I just can't see it that way.
So you believe that somebody entering the United States illegally, understand escaping poverty and adverse conditions, that isn't that bad? Or am I just not? Because if that's the case, Ron, you know, I know we're friends, but I don't agree with you at all on that.
Well, I'm saying it's the same thing as people trying to escape Nazi Germany and being denied and being sent back and being executed. This is the same kind of a thing that's going on all over the world now with people trying to escape oppression. Don't we have a role as a country with a Statue of Liberty to do something about this other than what we're doing?
Well, then you seek asylum and you enter the country legally, which is great. And that's what the country is built on. We're a country of immigrants, but legal immigrants.
Well, that's what these women are doing at the border, and they're being locked up. And their kids are being taken away from them. They're coming from
right.
Asylum.
But I asked about the illegal immigrants. People are obviously scaling a fence or a body of water or some other barrier. Not people looking for asylum. That's different. the people who are obviously coming in this country illegally. And the kids are innocent bystanders. And in my opinion, they're horrible parents. They're teaching the kids it's okay to go ahead and just enter somewhere because it's better. What if I were to say, well, my house isn't that nice. Maybe I should just go to a really fancy part of town and break into someone's house and live there instead. I mean, is that a fair analogy? Am I making a mockery of it? Or do you understand what I'm getting at?
I mean, I know what you're getting at, but I don't think it's the same situation. I just don't see it that way. I'm sorry.
Okay. I mean, we can agree to disagree. I understand it's a difficult topic. And believe me, my opinion tends to waver every day on this. It's very nerve-wracking and very upsetting. As an American, I'm very upset, very upset over this. But I don't have any tolerance for people entering the country illegally, which involving scaling a body of water or a fence or other barrier.
What about Melania intervening to indicate she was very distressed about this? I thought that was interesting. Sunday she did that.
I think Melania, like many first ladies, doesn't agree with her husband on all issues. We talked about Betty Ford and both Presidents Bush and their wives.
Laura Bush, yeah.
They didn't agree with her husband on many issues. Pro-life is... Pro-choice is the most obvious one, but there were some others also. Betty Ford, especially, reading up a little about her, she was definitely to the left and not really in agreement with her husband on a lot of things, but she certainly stood by him. So we're seeing that, and Melania definitely. You wouldn't think that she would have a lot of the same political beliefs that Donald Trump would, but you never quite know because she is a little bit mysterious.
More than a little mysterious, like what happened for a month.
I know we've asked before, Ron, but is there a solution to this immigration crisis? And it's a crisis, to put it mildly. And am I reasonable in saying that there is a big difference between people breaking into this country, scaling a body of water or fence or barrier, versus people looking for asylum, versus this other issue where people are here legally and for some reason ICE is badgering them with questions about their legal residency and possibly deporting them. That's an obviously totally different issue. Do we need to?
Yeah, ICE, I think, has become a disgrace the way they've been behaving, and I think they've been given license to act abusively toward people who are legally in this country, and it's just outrageous. You know, to me, it's like the Nazi Gestapo. I don't see much difference. I really don't.
I mean, I would say we have some differing views on people entering illegally, but on everything else, we're probably pretty similar. And the kids are innocent bystanders, and I don't know what the best solution is, and we certainly don't have one at this point. I just can't believe in my lifetime how much immigration has escalated. We're speaking with Dr. Ron Fineman, our official presidentologist and political commentator here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio, beginning today's show with the sensitive, controversial, and escalating problem of immigration. And, Ron, it seems like literally every day this problem becomes more serious and more prevalent. I don't recall even, 15, 20 years ago, immigration being thought of as one of the top 10 issues in this country, and now it's in the top 3, if not number 1. Do you see it continuing to increase in prevalence and sensitivity? Do you think there'll be a resolution? Is it a lot of it just because of President Trump and his policies?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the Republican Party has repudiated the idea of being open on immigration. Very few are willing to do it. You got to remember, George W. Bush did want to deal with immigration. Ronald Reagan did deal with immigration. H.W. Bush did deal with immigration. Bill Clinton did, and also Obama did, both parties. And yet now there seems to be no desire because of the right wing and the Republican Party and the House Freedom Caucus particularly stands in the way. And a lot of the Senate Republicans don't care. And we have a president who doesn't care about the immigration issue. He's exploited it from the moment he announced his campaign, which is just 3 years ago now, as of June 16th. I think that we're in a real problem. We've never had an issue like this in my lifetime of this kind of resentment and hatred of immigrants. And again, I understand there are issues about illegal immigration, but I mean, even the whole concept of immigration itself, the white supremacist groups are growing, and the Klan and other groups like that, and they're being encouraged by Trump's rhetoric and his policies.
So let's talk about another controversial, sensitive topic. Is there a bromance between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump? What are your thoughts about that meeting, the famous handshake, people standing for attention, that comment? What were your thoughts when you heard about all that stuff?
I thought that that was nice they met. I'm glad that the two people met. It's good they're having discussions, but I think he's too easy to think that North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat and to believe everything's going to work out fine. It would not work out that quickly anyway. It would take years to prove that it's really working out. And at the same time, he rips up the Iran agreement, which was working and was verifiable. And there's no verifiableness at all to this agreement with Kim. Nothing has been done specifically. And to me, he is a fool to believe that everything is fine. And all that matters is that the other side praises him all the time, as Kim obviously did. While at the same time he's attacking, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who said nothing wrong in just saying Canada was going to do what's good for its own nation. It makes sense that he would say that. And the way he was rude toward the leaders of Japan, Germany, France, and Great Britain at the recent summit, it's just astounding. I just don't understand how the Republican Party sits by and keeps mum about this when he's destroying the whole foreign policy, setup of the United States for the last 75 years, which kept the peace and advanced American interests.
Ron, do you think it's important or necessary for a president to meet with an enemy like Kim Jong-un? Do you think it's important, again, in this age of nuclear weapons and so much tension?
I'm not against a meeting. Look, after all, Khrushchev met Eisenhower, and Khrushchev met Kennedy, and Nixon met Brezhnev, and of course Gorbachev and Reagan, and all the others, all the other cases. But the thing is, you don't come away from it thinking, oh, the issue's resolved, and now we're buddy-buddy. None of the others ever did that. This is what's crazy. Not the idea that we meet, but that you somehow come to a quick conclusion that everything is resolved, when it certainly is not resolved.
Now, how can we explain that a few months ago Donald Trump called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, and it wasn't yes, in a positive way, and now they're best buds? I mean, obviously there's rhetoric, and I know it's not a great analogy, but remember President Bush and President Clinton, they're kind of like on a bromance, and they were certainly rivals during the election, one of the most negative campaigns ever. And now they're best. Now it's like they're best friends. Again, not a perfect analogy, but you know what I mean. People,
well, those
can
are two presidents. They're not a tyrant.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's not a perfect analogy, but you get the idea. Can people put aside their differences and be friends and realize that we're all human beings on this planet together? Or is it a little different when one of them is Kim Jong-un?
Well, I think in theory you can work to try to better relations, but not have an unrealistic viewpoint of what the situation is. And I think Trump, it's just because of flattery and ego that as long as he's praised by the other side, he's willing to overlook everything. Well, if somebody like Trudeau or May or Merkel or Macron dares to say anything a little critical, right away he's on the attack. Part of life is accepting criticism from others, not just looking for praise all the time. So, yes, it's good to have the relationship, but not come to an unreasonable result to think that it's all resolved, because it's not. I can be certain of that. Anybody in their right mind knows that, and all our intelligence agencies say the same thing, or our foreign policy experts from the past say the same thing. I mean, Trump is unhinged when it comes to dealing with the world, and it's very scary and very dangerous, along with the tariff issue, which now I think is going to bring down the international economy with what he's doing with China and with Mexico and Canada and the European Union. He's going to really undermine the American economy and the world economy, as well as world peace, with his reckless behavior.
Now, Ron, you sometimes speak with the interviewer to the stars, Scott Spears, in addition to speaking with myself. And if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
last time you spoke with Scott, he asked you, and it was almost in a comical way, but, a little bit of humor is good to break up a tense situation, as far as I'm concerned. He asked you, of course, he calls you Dr. Feynman. So anyway, he said, Dr. Feynman, is there anything about President Trump that you like or think he's accomplished? And as I recall, your answer, I don't think you had anything that you liked about him. So if he were to ask you that question again today, would you say, well, I like that he met with Kim Jong-un and he's trying to iron out his differences? Or do you think that possible repercussions of this meeting outweigh the importance of the fact that they did get together?
Well, I would praise that he met with him, but I would also condemn that he destroyed the whole relationship with the European Union and Canada and Mexico and Japan. To me, that is outrageous. And so, yes, it's a plus. It is. But I don't think it's quite the plus he makes it out to be. It would take years to know if it really is a major positive point. And I don't see it as being as positive as he does to think it's all resolved because of one meeting of a few hours. I think that's living in a dream world.
We wouldn't put this on a par with Billy Carter's trip or with President Nixon visiting China. This is something totally different because I guess you don't really hear about politicians or their families visiting Korea. And is there any parallel at all? I mean, you mentioned about Eisenhower and Khrushchev, for example. And I remember Nixon in China. Is there any kind of a parallel, or is this something totally different in the course of U.S. history?
I think it's unique because of North Korea's nuclear potential. In the case of Russia, they already had the nuclear weapon when we met with them. China did also, and they did not act internationally, even though they were maybe critical of the United States. They didn't act in the way that Kim Jong-un has acted under the last few presidents. And I don't think after the experience we've had under the last few presidents and Kim Jong-un, his father and also the grandfather, that we can be so trustworthy so quickly. We could be happy at the meeting taking place, but not believe that it means it's to resolve the issue, and there's going to be a lot of watchful waiting to see what actually comes out of this.
Also, Ron, why do you think President Obama never met with Kim Jong-un? You never really heard much about Korea when Obama was president. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, Obama, when he was running, had said he'd be willing to meet with the Iranian government. He never did. And I even think he said North Korea. And, of course, the Republicans said it shows how reckless he is, how dangerous he is, how naive he is. And now with Trump, they don't feel that way. So it's all politics, no principle at all. I think it's always good if you can have nations' leaders meet. But you can't have the kind of hostility and antagonism that was going on for the first year between Kim and Trump. I think that was very dangerous, and that's never happened any other time with any other leader to have so much condemnation of both sides from each, you know, toward each other. And that's why this whole thing is so weird that now suddenly he has a love affair with Kim, and I don't think that we can really trust Kim Jong-un. I really don't think so, and I think he's too easy to give up the whole issue of the threat of North Korea. And God forbid, if something goes wrong in North Korea attacks us, you realize how he will look at history? If that happens, he'll be seen as the biggest, I'm talking about Trump, as the biggest disaster ever in our history if something goes wrong in that whole relationship. Let's hope it works. But I just think it's crazy that his belief of the whole issue is solved.
Now, people are saying that Kim Jong-un has pulled the wool over Trump's eyes and played him like a violin, so to speak. I guess we're not really sure if that's the case. I mean, it might be, or maybe we may find, you know, 5-10 years down the road, this was a beneficial meeting and broke the ice. I guess we're still kind of finding out.
It could be, but we can never know now. That's the point. There's no way to know. So I applaud him for meeting with him, but not his reaction to the meeting. Trump's reaction is much too far out in left field, as I would say. You don't make a judgment like that after one meeting. You just sound encouraged, but you don't go and rave about the other side.
Do you think there will be future meetings or Kim Jong-un visiting the United States? Could that happen?
Well, apparently he's talking about planning to invite him to the White House. Wow. And maybe he would go to Panmunjom. I don't know. It's very possible. I suppose it would be quite historic. It's like when Nixon went to China. But even as much as China was a rival and an enemy, they weren't quite as reckless in the same way as North Korea has been. And it's hard to see it as an equal situation. Nixon, of course, was very educated on diplomacy. Trump has no background in diplomacy at all.
But we do agree, and we've talked about this before. Kim Jong-un, he's in his 30s. His age is a little bit under dispute, but he's somewhere in the 34 to 37 range. He's a very smart man. I mean, we're not saying we agree with him or we support him, but he's not stupid. He knows where it's at and understands foreign policy.
Yes, he does.
And what's up with that outfit? He wears the same coat every time. I didn't know.
That's funny. I don't know what to make of it. You know, I'm surprised that, you know, since he's so big, Trump, on people being tall, he made fun of Senator Bob Corker for being short, that he didn't make fun of Kim Jong-un for being short and also heavy, but he didn't say anything. It's just such a double standard. He goes after the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman, insults him, but then he doesn't insult Kim Jong-un.
Wasn't he telling the photographer to use an angle to make them both look real tall and handsome? Wasn't that one of the things that we heard about?
His behavior is just beyond the pale, as is Rudy Giuliani, who is the so-called lawyer. He's becoming more and more of a lunatic every day, an embarrassment to himself.
We're speaking with our official presidentologist and historian, Dr. Ron L. Feinman. Two sensitive topics, intense ones, immigration, our relations with North Korea. Let's talk about something that is more along the lines of the kind of things I prefer to talk about. We want to talk about the serious issues, and we must. They're important, I mean, to put it mildly. But presidential statistics is certainly an interest of mine, and that interest has been piqued and increased since we started having Dr. Feinman on the air with us. And that was your blog, Ron, from June 13th, 2018, which was last Wednesday, if I am not mistaken. I was always good at math. About vice presidents. Mike Pence visited Columbus back on Friday, and that was the same time that they had the Pride festivities. And so you can imagine the conflict. It was actually a big dance party to welcome his presence in the capital city, and it made national news. So all kinds of interesting goings on here in the Buckeye State. But you're saying that Mike Pence is a weak vice president, essentially because he is intimidated by his boss, the President Donald. You also mentioned
that's what unfortunately becomes reality. I'm willing to challenge him in any way. He fawns over Trump in a very degrading way and manner that we have not seen in any other modern vice president. And I didn't think that a year ago, but after watching for a year, I really think that Mike Pence is a weak vice president, yes. And he's certainly trying to just protect his own future by keeping his mouth shut and not having any issues with the president, even behind the scenes. He seems intimidated by him. Yeah.
He wants to be a bit subservient, but he's also looking at the fact that he'd rather be sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the Oval Office. And Pence is 59 years old, so relatively young. I think he has aspirations, and we've certainly not heard the last of the guy. You wrote in your blog, Ron, that until Tricky Dicky, or President Richard M. Nixon, when he was vice president under Dwight Eisenhower, no vice president really did too much, never had much impact on on his president. Hubert Humphrey, under Lyndon Johnson, knew he had to support the Vietnam War, but did not lose his dignity in the process. Of course, Spiro Agnew, he was known as being a bit on the corrupt side, and he resigned, and Richard Nixon resigned shortly after that. Gerald Ford kept his dignity under Nixon in the 8 months he was VP before succeeding Nixon in the White House. Walter Mondale, one of my favorites, became the most active and engaged vice president, totally on the same wavelength with Jimmy Carter. George H.W. Bush, well, not a bosom buddy of Ronald Reagan. And that's probably because they had a rather hotly contested primary before Reagan won.
1980,
And there were probably a few grudges, but they realized we're on the same team and we can shake hands, understand our differences, and understand we'd still be a good team. Dan Quayle was a disaster. And, you know, again, he didn't really do too much. He was known mostly for his misspellings and assorted goofy goofy escapades.
Yes. A real embarrassment, as I wrote,
But I think, and people have said, Ron, he's probably more intelligent than he was given credit for. And he's kind of an enigma. I think he's, one of his sons is in Congress currently, right, or is in government.
Was in Congress for one term.
And like Mike Pence, Dan Quayle was from Indiana. So he certainly has connections to our station here in Marion, Ohio. And, of course, Marion is a county that Indianapolis, the capital of Indiana, is in.
Yes.
Of course, only I would know something so arcane
well,
as that.
I knew it. I don't live in Indiana or Ohio.
Al Gore was very close and involved with Bill Clinton until he got Bill Clinton got involved with Monica Lewinsky. Just had to say that. That was kind of funny. Dick Cheney was almost president in the sense that he was leaned on by George W. Bush in the first term, losing some of the power and input in the second term. So we had seen, Ron, basically in my lifetime, vice presidents becoming increasingly more powerful, more visible. But now we're kind of going
Joe
back.
Biden, too.
Right. Now kind of going backwards. Now, interestingly, everybody kind of knows Mike Pence is the VP, whereas you might have asked some people, like under George H.W. Bush, who was the VP? I bet a lot of people wouldn't even know who the VP was. But everybody knows Mike Pence is VP. Because, interestingly, he's kind of a he's a very polarizing figure, and his beliefs are well known. But, ironically, doesn't seem like he has a lot of power, which is kind of unusual. So it's a unique vice presidency for sure. Now, with the Trump administration continuing, assuming he remains president, that's another topic that we discuss regularly. But assuming Donald Trump finishes out his term, and there's about over 2.5 years to go, do you think that Mike Pence will become more powerful, more visible as a policymaker, or do you think he'll continue to be well known, but in terms of policies and power, kind of negligible?
If for some reason, Trump and Pence get reelected, I think in the second term, with definitely Trump having to leave after the second term, although he wishes he could stay for life, I think Mike Pence will be able to separate himself more in, by 2021, 2022, if he's there, because he'll be looking ahead to want to succeed him, yes. I'm not sure how Trump will react at that point, but I mean, I do think at this point that Pence is very much cautious about making Trump blow up, because I've read some stories that there have been some issues between them about staff members that Trump didn't want Pence to have, and he let this guy go, a particular person. So I think he's very timid at going at challenging Trump on anything. But I think once reelected, it might be a different situation, because he can't be fired, and because Trump will become a lame duck automatically when he's reelected, and Pence would be looking to his own future and would want to separate himself, I think, more at that point. But that's assuming a lot, and I do not see Trump and Pence being reelected in 2020. I do not still see Trump finishing this term. I think Pence will be in office before the term is over.
One more question, Ron, that just entered my brain as I was looking over your blogs. Germany, of course, is now one country. There's no West Germany and East Germany. Is there ever a possibility that
1990,
that Korea could become one country? I know that's not really your expertise area, but they're in the news so much. Is that a possibility, or am I just fantasizing?
I would think not, unless, and it's not going to happen, North Korea's government collapses. But then China would not want South Korea, making a unified Korea. I don't think Korea being, on the border with China, I don't think that could happen. The same, it's different than with Germany. Germany's history is very different. I just don't see it happening. But of course, you learn that you can never say anything for sure, because I never thought the Berlin Wall was going to come down. So I mean, who can say? But I can't imagine it anytime soon, that would occur because of the history of North and South Korea.
So it is possible.
And China being on the boundary.
Right, but not likely. There are some parallels with Germany, but many things that are different also.
Yes. I wanted to bring in here before we leave, because I don't know how much more time we have. We should celebrate George H.W. Bush at his 94th birthday on June 12th.
Well, let's go ahead and sing happy birthday. Let's do it. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear President Bush, number one. Hope your birthday is lots of fun. Okay, let's get on to another topic.
And Jimmy Carter is waiting until October 1st to reach 94 himself. He's on 11 days behind, so now that's the next thing to accomplish, to make sure we have two 94-year-old presidents. None have ever reached that level.
A couple of talks regarding mergers. I talked about Korea becoming one country. Well, it may happen, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. This thing about California becoming California, North California, South California, what do you think about that? And is that really a possibility, or is it more, again, something people are only dreaming about?
Well, actually, I'm going to write about that this next week. I do not see it happening that California will split. I don't really see the virtue of it either. The only difference people say is you'd have four more senators. You wouldn't have more congressmen. You'd have four more senators if you had three Californias. But I just don't see that coming about. And the Congress would have to agree to it, even if California voted for it. It's not automatic. If that's the case, we could also divide Texas into a few states, or Florida. Even years ago, people used to say have a South Florida and a North Florida, but I don't see it happening. I just don't believe that will be occurring. But there is a lot of discussion now that it's going to be on the ballot in November for California, yes, but I don't see it as positive thing to do.
The thing about California, most people understand there's San Diego, San Francisco, L.A., and Sacramento. Like Columbus, it's a rapidly growing capital city. But most of California is desert and rural. It's only that little strip.
Yes.
And there are differences. And, of course, every state is like that. In Florida also, Miami and Tampa.
Absolutely.
They're a little different from northern Florida, for one thing, the tropical climate. But you still have Jacksonville and Tallahassee and other cities in northern Florida. But, again, you enter California from Nevada, and you're in the middle of a remote area, not quite anything like L.A. or San Francisco. So there are differences, but states' diversity is part of what makes them appealing. But California has become very populous and has a large influence on this country, and maybe it's better just to have two states instead, or should we just celebrate its diversity? In Texas, a little different because the big cities are scattered. Now, a lot of Texas is rural and sparsely populated, but you're never that far from one of the major cities, whereas in California, the cities are pretty much concentrated on a strip. And California is a very long state from north to south. So there are some differences. Of course, Alaska also, almost all of Alaska is remote and too cold to inhabit.
But Alaska only has about 700,000 people.
Right.
We're not going to divide Alaska.
Right. But you understand there are some differences. And I guess what I think is that here in Ohio, of course, there are rural parts, but you're never more than an hour away from a reasonably sized city. And there are a lot of cities in Marion, Chillicothe, Zanesville, small cities where you feel like you're in a small town, but they're big enough where there are things to do. And if you want a larger town, you're never more than an hour away. And Marion, Columbus is 50 minutes or so away. Dayton, Toledo, Cleveland, Akron. Not too far. And if you want a rural area, that involves going one or two counties over. But you're never that far from a different culture while being in the same state. But California, again, being different because it is so massive, and it's one extreme.
I must point out, Texas, if you go from one end to the other, is 900 miles. So if you're in Houston, it's quite different from being in El Paso. It's many hundreds of miles away. So actually, Texas is larger than California in land area. So,
but the cities are. But there are, the large cities are kind of spread out. Where in California, they're pretty much on that strip. That's by the ocean.
Except for Sacramento, yeah.
Right, and in area, yes, Texas is huge, and Dallas and Houston are big, and they're getting bigger. Florida too. Again, it's like you have the southern part and the northern part, but even in the middle, you're not that far from a major city. So,
well, it's 600 miles from south to north. People don't realize all the way to the Panhandle, it's about 600 miles if you start in Miami and go up to Tallahassee.
But I would say, though, again, to sum it up, if there's any state that would be divided, California would be the most obvious one. But I think the idea of just embracing the diversity of the state is preferable.
I would leave California alone.
You have two senators, regardless of whether you're a sparsely populated state like Alaska or Vermont, or you're a very populated state like California. But representatives are based upon population, and that also affects your electoral votes. Though that's kind of skewed because electoral votes is based upon the number of people you have in Congress total. So it's at least three. Whereas with California, it's based upon number of representatives plus the two senators. So just a quirk in our government, obviously. But I don't.
And I want to point out what you've already said about rural America. Rural America has very little population, but it has a very different mentality than urban or suburban America. And that's what's splitting the whole country wide apart, you know, even in politics because of that.
Right. I think that's one reason why Ohio is, and that's a good point, a very good point, is an important state to win and to campaign in, because we have urban, suburban, rural, and usually you're no more than half an hour away from changing the type, changing the landscape of the state that you're in. Marion being a good example. You want urban, Columbus, 45, 50 minutes. Columbus suburbs, less than 30 minutes. You want rural, 15 minutes. You can be in a rural area. And Marion itself is kind of a small city, somewhat suburban feel. And a lot of the state is like that. And that might very well be why it's considered to be such an important state to campaign.
Well, historically, it's been the most important state. And I think, as I said in the past, whoever wins Ohio will win the White House in 2020. You've got to spend a lot of time both sides in Ohio.
Obviously, I know more about Ohio than other states, but maybe that's part of the reason. It's kind of hard to say, and we've had a lot of presidents, obviously. But
all Republicans, though, no Democrats.
It just seems like Ohio, which doesn't have certainly near the electoral votes of Texas or California, is such an important state for campaigning and an important state to win if you want to be in the White House.
Yeah, every single president in modern times has won Ohio. Like Jimmy Carter won Ohio over Gerald Ford, and that won him the election in 1976.
Right. And I thought Trump would win Ohio, but I thought it would be very close. But once I found out that he won Ohio quite resoundingly, I knew the election was over. And Ohio does have a major indication of how...
Well, the whole Midwest does. The Midwestern states will decide the election. Wisconsin, Michigan, and also Missouri is very important.
Right. So it's not just the population of the state. It has to do with the location and the demographics of your voters, percentage of people that vote, and differences between where Republicans live versus where Democrats live and where a lot of independents are. You know,
independence is becoming more and more important.
Yeah, you know, I proclaim I'm an independent. I don't really believe in or understand political parties. And there are probably a lot more people like myself. They may not be as vocal about what they believe, but I think that they can make a decision based upon the candidate. And even as we've talked about, Ron, you don't necessarily vote for Democrats. You look at the candidate. And there are many Republicans that you like, and there are plenty of Democrats you don't like. And you look
at the
person.
That's
party correct. Party is only part of the picture. Yeah, we're almost done here, Ron. And, of course, not having had a show last week, I knew this would only scratch the surface what we wanted to talk about. But in the last minute or two, let me ask you what you think about, I think, the other end of the coin, the telecom mergers. I do not think that AT&T should be merging with Spectrum.
I am not for mergers. It's too much, too many mergers, and that's not good for the consumer. It's too much power in the hands of a few corporations. I've always been against that. But as a progressive, I would be. Progressives feel that way.
We also have T-Mobile and Sprint. I'm not in favor of that one either. And I think we need to have diversity in companies. We need to have competition. That's what keeps prices reasonable and improves customer service. It seems like whenever companies merge, the customer service goes down the toilet.
Yeah, mergers is not a good thing, and progressives and liberals would not support mergers, and I definitely do not.
And would you? And we'll close out the show, Ron, because you and I both remember the breakup of AT&T back in the early 80s. Hasn't AT&T become a much bigger company now after the breakup? They've actually reassembled, because these baby Bells, many of them are now part of AT&T. Of course, there was no internet and U-verse and DirecTV back then, but ironically, hasn't the AT&T monopoly kind of gone the other way, totally defeating the purpose of the original breakup?
Yes, I do not like it. I do not like it, and I give part of the blame for that to Bill Clinton, because he was one of those people that allowed mergers in the 90s when Democrats usually do not promote that, but he did allow it. He was quite a conservative guy when it came to big business, and it may have won him support by some people, but I've always thought it was a mistake to allow, you know, merging of the oil industry, also of Exxon and Mobil. That was a mistake too in the 1990s.
Yeah, we'll revisit that maybe next week, Ron. It's an important issue, especially for me, with net neutrality, which is a similar topic. It relates to telecom companies getting away with too much stuff. And it's a sensitive topic, and one I certainly feel very strongly about, and one we probably agree.
And the laws of net neutrality.
Right, one we probably agree about almost completely.
Yes.
Versus immigration, where we don't have total agreement. We have some agreement, but there are some areas where there's some... difference of opinion. Well, thanks again, Ron, for being with us today. Dr. Ron Fineman, the official historian, political commentator, and presidentologist here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio.
Thank you again very much for inviting me, Adam.